Today, we have Alan Anderson, who calls himself a PhD candidate in Department of War Studies, working on the laws of war, naval strategy, which won't surprise us, given that we're here to hear him speak about just that. The recipient, this is what I'm looking for, of the 2013-14 Rear Admiral John D. Hayes Pre-Doctoral Fellowship from the United States Naval History and Heritage Command. So he comes with credentials, he comes with an interesting subject, and he now has the floor. Over to you, Alan.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and thank you all for being here today. I want to thank Dr. James and the British Commission for Maritime History for inviting me to speak here today. As you might be able to tell from certainly how I sound, I have a pretty bad cold, so I apologize in advance if I have to stop and blow my nose or something during the course of this lecture. I also need to acknowledge the generous financial support of the Society for Nautical Research through a research grant and also the United States Naval History and Heritage Command. As you heard, in that regard, I have to state that the views and opinions expressed in this lecture are my own and not those of the United States Navy or the United States Naval History and Heritage Command. Now, also by sort of way of preliminary statement, this subject matter forms the greater part of my PhD thesis, so I could probably drone on and on for some number of hours. However, lest you be concerned about that, I have my eyes firmly fixed on the prize, as they say, at the back of this room, which are the refreshments waiting us when I'm done. So, at the conclusion of this lecture, so I shall endeavor to stay within the allotted time. And if not, I'm certain that some or all of you will make sure that I do. Also, since this topic forms a big chunk of my PhD research, I necessarily am going to have to be superficial in some respects, and I may miss or not touch on someone's favorite topic from the 1899 and 1907 conferences. So if I do, if I don't hit everything, I apologize in advance, but please don't hesitate to interrupt me. And ask a question. I'd love to have a dialogue as we go along through here, as opposed to just simply a lecture until the end. I want to start by first discussing just a little bit about why I believe the 1899 and 1907 peace conferences are or should be important to students of the Royal Navy in the pre-First World War era. And I want to start by suggesting that this date is an important date in pre-First World War naval history, not just for the Royal Navy, but even more generally for all navies. It's a date that I suspect, or that I think naval historians should have a greater familiarity with, and I wonder if anyone here knows the significance of this date. This is the date upon which Nicholas II, Tsar of all the Russias, I love that title, acting through his foreign minister, surprised the ambassadors and minister plenipotentiaries to his court with a proposal for an international peace conference. And the primary subjects were going to be the limitation of armaments and the means of ensuring the peaceful resolution of disputes among nations. Now, while there is certainly disagreement over what motivated Nicholas II to issue his call for a peace conference, there's little doubt that it had nothing to do, really, with the Russian Navy or naval issues. However, this date, August 24th, ushered in an unprecedented 10-year period of focus on the laws of war and their adaptation and adoption to naval warfare. During the slightly more than 10 years, from 1898 until the conclusion of the London Naval Conference in 1909, the laws of war were never far from the minds of the leaders of the Royal Navy, their civilian masters, or for that matter, naval planners in other navies around the world. For more than 10 years, the Royal Navy had to consider the potential implications of the laws of war, of naval warfare, in terms of what they would and would not be able to do, and what weapons they would or would not be allowed to use, and how they might be allowed to use them. By the same token, naval strategists and planners made efforts to mold and shape the laws of war to suit their own particular needs. So it was a two-way street. It's important, I think, to keep in mind that prior to 1898, the laws of naval warfare were practically non-existent, at least in terms of any formal rules or conventions. There was the 1856 Declaration of Paris, negotiated initially and signed by the nations involved in the Crimean War, which outlawed privateering, and also formally adopted some rules regarding the immunity from seizure during war of private property on ships sailing either under neutral flags or the flags of belligerents. That declaration was highly criticized in Great Britain as an unreasonable and ill-considered restriction on the freedom of action of the Royal Navy during wartime. In the aftermath of the 1856 declaration, the Royal Navy zealously guarded its prerogatives and freedom of action in warfare. Prior to the 1874 Brussels Convention to discuss the laws of war, the British delegates to that convention were instructed in clear and unmistakable terms not to consider or debate in any way provisions or conventions relating to the laws of naval warfare. Any such discussions were off the table as far as Great Britain were concerned. Other than the much criticized Declaration of Paris of 1856, as the end of the 19th century approached, and until the Tsar called for an international peace conference, the conduct of naval warfare was pretty much wide open for the Royal Navy, and that's exactly how the Admiralty wanted it. The Royal Navy was easily the largest and most powerful fleet afloat, and as the, if you will, biggest dog on the block, they wanted to be assured that it could do whatever it wanted in time of war against any possible foe. One other preliminary matter to keep in mind, and one of the reasons why the Royal Navy viewed any formalized laws of war with consternation, is, I believe, that there is a big difference between the laws of land warfare and the laws of naval warfare. With regard to the laws of land warfare, traditionally and historically, they were not applicable to conflicts involving savages, non-believers, or the other, or rebels. The formal laws of land warfare, to the extent they had been adopted in formal conventions, were applicable only to conflicts between signatories to those conventions. Thus, for land warfare, there were clearly possible outs or conflicts in which they would not apply. For the British Army in the 50 years after the end of the Crimean War, its conflicts had been against savages or rebels against the crown, and so to the extent the British Army followed or imposed upon itself any limitations on how it conducted warfare, those limitations or restrictions essentially were as a result of its own generosity. The British Army was not required by any formal or informal laws of war to conduct its operations in any particular manner when dealing with conflicts against tribal savages at the edges of the empire in the latter half of the 19th century. In contrast, the Royal Navy was unlikely to have such a means of avoiding the application of laws of naval warfare. It was highly unlikely that any savages or rebels or non-believers that the Royal Navy might face would have a fleet with which to do battle. The Royal Navy had to have recognized, in my view, that any likely conflicts in which it was a belligerent, the other side would be a major nation, a naval power of some sort, of some degree, but likely to have been a signatory to any formal convention relating to the laws of naval warfare. And certainly at the end of the 19th century, the Royal Navy then viewed it as its likely opponents in war, Russia and France, which undoubtedly would be signatories to any convention. Certainly as the first decade of the 20th century developed and the Royal Navy's likely opponent became Germany, it too would almost certainly be a signatory to any formal convention relating to the laws of naval warfare. In addition, and finally in this preliminary matters, I think it's important to keep in mind, in my view anyway, that the era of that we're talking about, the late Victorian and early Edwardian era, was one in which the leaders of the nations were gentlemen, aristocracy or nobles, and they were very focused on maintaining their honor and in playing by the rules of the game. It was paramount. And I don't think that it is likely that the leaders who controlled the government or the Royal Navy during this era would be of the view that, well, we're going to adopt laws of naval warfare and then not follow them, at least unless and until an opposing belligerent failed to follow them. Thus, I think that the Royal Navy's leaders, and certainly the civilian leadership in governments of the day, understood that the laws of naval warfare would have to be followed, and that such laws could and would actually impose limitations on what practices and weapons and procedures they could follow in time of war. I think that the naval and civilian leaders took the application of the laws of war to naval warfare seriously. Now, with this brief overview in mind, let's turn to the 1899 Peace Conference and the Royal Navy. The Peace Conference has not been studied or considered by naval historians to any extent. And you have to ask, why is that? And perhaps it stems from the original groundbreaking work of Arthur Martyr, which is the foundation, for better or worse, from which most modern naval histories spring. His classic work on the history of the naval Royal Navy begins almost two decades before the 1899 Peace Conference. The first volume of his multi-volume endeavor, The Anatomy of British Sea Power, contains a chapter entitled The Hague Fiasco. But Martyr devoted most of his discussion to the reaction of the English popular press to the Tsar's invitation, and less than three pages to the conference itself. Perhaps one might ask, why was that? Well, in Martyr's archive, I found that in the late 1970s, Martyr wrote a paper or a speech, I'm not sure that it was ever given or published, in which he recounted how he started doing his multi-volume history. And apparently in England in 1938, he asked the Admiralty for access to many files relating to the time period covered in his first volume. And he recalled that, to his surprise, he received copies of everything that he asked for, 25 files, except for two. One of them, he remembered, even 40 years later, was the file on the 1899 Peace Conference. That was one of the two files to which he was denied access. Because of this neglect, I think that the role of then Vice Admiral John Fisher, Jackie Fisher, at the 1899 Peace Conference is also essentially lacking. Fisher was Britain's technical naval delegate to the conference. His first biographer described Fisher's participation in less than three pages, most of which is based upon an article written by a journalist after Fisher retired from the Admiralty in 1910. Ruddock McKay devoted less than seven pages to the 1899 conference. Most of this account is either inaccurate as to what Fisher did or based on third-party descriptions, taken from Fisher's rather questionable recollections published nearly 20 years later. Neither the 1899 conference nor Fisher's role as a delegate in it should be so ignored or lightly considered. The 1899 conference was a foundational event in the Royal Navy's consideration of the laws of war in the years before the First World War, and issues and questions applicable to naval strategy were raised, decided, or pushed off to a future meeting of the world's nations. Not for the last time, the Admiralty found itself in conflict with the desires of the country's civilian leadership regarding the goals to be achieved during an international proceeding. For the Royal Navy, the 1899 conference was the beginning of a nearly 10-year voyage through the shoals of the laws of war and naval strategy. For Fisher, his participation was his first real foray into international relations and diplomacy, and it was an educational experience for him. He surely understood that when the next conference occurred, the laws applicable to naval warfare raised real issues to be dealt with seriously. Now, in the run-up to the 1899 conference, remember it was announced in August of 1898, it was very generally, you know, not well received. None of the nations really wanted to go to it or thought much of it. Britain agreed late and decided to go. No one wanted to say no. Britain took a very cautious view, and it was only after carefully surveying the other nations that Britain decided to go. When it became clear that Britain would go, in the preparations for it, which started in earnest in January of 1899, after Russia suggested an 8-point agenda, several of them really focused on the Royal Navy, or in effect on the Royal Navy, because it related to the adaptation and adoption of the laws of land war to naval warfare. Indeed, after receiving the suggested agenda, the Foreign Office sent a copy of the proposal to the Admiralty asking for any observations it might have, and the Admiralty's response, George Goschen, the First Lord of the Admiralty, his reaction was to tell the First Sea Lord, well, I've written to Lord Salisbury to see whether he really means this, whether they really want any observations from us. Goschen writes to Salisbury and tells him that, you know, if you're really serious about this, whoever's going to go on behalf of the Navy is going to need a great deal of coaching, but he assumed that the plan was that if the to proceed as if the proceedings were serious, since the objective was to make the inevitable collapse of the conference appear to be the fault of one of the other nations. Now, before the Admiralty could present its considered views to the Foreign Office, it turns out that the government took a little bit different tact. And in March of 1899, several months before the conference started and before the delegates are even determined, Goschen writes to Salisbury and says, hey, maybe we should propose make a disarmament proposal to Russia. Maybe we should propose to actually cut back on naval armaments. And it's conceived by Goschen, approved by Salisbury, and the whole thing is orchestrated in less than 10 days. In March of 1899, I have found nothing to indicate that the uniformed leaders of the Royal Navy actually knew about this proposal. It was done through the ambassador to Russia, and the result was that Russia said, well, gee, thank you very much. It was actually presented directly to the Tsar. Thank you very much. But we really can't engage in true disarmament right now because we need to build up our navy to be comparable to that of Japan. When, you know, after that, and the Admiralty now is realizing that, gee, they really do want our observations on this proposed peace conference, the Admiralty didn't want to participate at all. They, in effect, wanted to adopt the approach from the 1874 conference in Brussels and not even discuss the laws of naval warfare or anything having to do with naval warfare. And their initial drafts of their memos to the Foreign Office make that very, very clear. And the Foreign Office isn't exactly being helpful during this time period. At one point, the Admiralty asked for a couple volumes of documents relating to the Geneva Convention of 1864, and the Foreign Office responded that the documents requested were bound in two volumes, quote, which cannot be conveniently spared from this office. However, if you will depute a gentleman to come and examine them at this office, the librarian and keeper of the papers will be happy to show them to you any day between the hours of 12 and 5 p.m. Now, the director of naval intelligence at the time, Reginald Custance, prepares the first draft of the response, makes it very clear that the Admiralty doesn't want the British delegates to be entertaining in any shape, directly or indirectly, anything relating to maritime operations in warfare. Eventually, it gets pared down a bit, but still takes the position that nothing should be discussed unless it's in our favor. At the same time, the government is getting pressure from the Chamber of Shipping regarding the immunity of private property at sea in time of war and the definition of contraband. And throughout this time period, these are two topics that continuously run along. The question of immunity of private property at sea is for the merchant fleet, certainly something that they would like to see, that in time of war, private property is, in effect, immune from capture, except if it's contraband or running a blockade. They also are concerned about the definition of what is contraband, to try to make that as narrow as possible, because they're concerned about losing whatever they're shipping. Now, of course, for the Royal Navy, their view is, on both of these, look, we're big, we can take care of all of the commercial interests, we'll take care of the merchant fleet if we're a belligerent, and if we're not a belligerent, nobody's going to touch us because they're not going to want to get in crossways with us. Now, Fisher, as everyone knows, or should know, was the naval delegate. And I think that his role at the 1899 conference has been greatly misunderstood. Abner Offer, in his great book on the First World War, An Agrarian Interpretation, describes Fisher as no respecter of the laws of war. And I have to disagree with that. I don't think there's any evidence, real evidence, that Fisher is no respecter of the laws of war. He was a combat veteran from China and the bombardment of Alexandria. I think that he, there was nothing to suggest that he wasn't going to follow the laws of war. He certainly was a great talker. Fisher liked to talk the talk. His rhetoric is way out there, but I think that was his approach. He wanted to have everybody else think that, you know, wait a minute, you really don't want to deal with the Royal Navy because they've got some guys who are just crazy running the show, and they're going to do some pretty wild things. When you look at the records of the conference, Fisher is actually a lot more reasonable than a lot of folks. In fact, certainly if you compare him to Alfred Thayer Mahan, who was the United States technical naval delegate, Mahan is, to the extent you think Fisher is right wing, Mahan is to the right of him. And Mahan is completely unbridled because there is no sort of background structure at the time in the United States Navy sort of imposing, here's sort of channeling him. Whereas the Admiralty has some very significant, very straightforward goals that they want to get. And I think that if you look at, you have to look at Fisher and the 1899 conference because it provides insights into some of the later actions that he does when he is first Sea Lord with regard to the laws of naval warfare. Now, there's a lot that is considered in the 1899 conference. One of the most interesting was a proposal which Britain very much and the Royal Navy very much supported, which was to ban submarines, torpedoes, and mines. If it had been passed, it would have eliminated a great deal of research in the years after that because they just wouldn't have been talking about it. Wouldn't really need to consider submarines, torpedoes, and mines. And this quote here is from the Admiralty, and it talks about why they want to ban submarines, torpedoes, and mines. It's a very, you know, self-interested view. It's very much a reaction to the idea that, well, we're going to face France and Russia. They're weaker. They're going to use these sort of underhanded means to defend themselves or to be offensive about it. So let's just ban them. And it was a proposal that Fisher advocated for, and he lost, in effect, by two votes. When I say lost by two votes, it means that almost all the other countries said, we will go along with this as long as it's unanimous. And that kind of ties into what I said earlier about everyone understanding that with regard to naval warfare, if you were a signatory, it was going to apply. So a lot of the votes in the 1899 conference are countries saying, we'll go along with this as long as it's unanimous. If everybody else is on board, we'll go with it. Two countries propose it, France and the United States. France, the Jeune Ecole is still around. They're looking at, they know that if they face the Royal Navy, they're going to be the weaker side, so they need whatever they can to go against them. And the United States, which is just sort of coming up with its Navy, and Mahan is out there, and he doesn't want to have anything that even remotely touches on the ability of the United States Navy to become a huge real blue water fleet. As I said, at the 1899 conference, when you look at it, Fisher is much more moderate. He takes positions that are less extreme than some of those that the Admiralty wanted on the limitation of naval guns and armor. Custin says in an internal minute that Fisher is clearly mixed up in what he's saying. Fisher takes more moderate views than the Admiralty with regard to the adaptation of the laws of land warfare to naval warfare. Ultimately, the Admiralty very reluctantly agrees. There's quite a bit of debate between the Admiralty and the delegation where the delegation is saying, hey, let's accept these. They're, you know, all right. And the Admiralty is like, no, we don't want to have anything to do with this. Finally, the Admiralty is convinced reluctantly to, okay, we'll go along with it as long as it maintains our maximum freedom of action. Salisbury is sort of in the middle of this, and he ends up siding with, okay, we've got to trust the delegates there. They think this is good. We'll go for it. A number of other topics, though, the shore ends of submarine cables, which may seem a little like, what is that about? At the time, all of the cables for underwater communications ended in Britain. So how you were going to control the ends of submarine cables was a big thing. Bombardment of undefended ports and towns, and the all-important immunity of private property at sea issue all just get deferred to the next convention. So at the end of it, you know, the Royal Navy, and certainly Fisher understand that whenever this next peace conference comes about, if it does come about, there's going to be a lot of stuff still to be covered and a lot of extra work involved. With regard to the 1899 conference, what you have then, I think, is that the Admiralty is fighting a defensive battle. They're forced to participate for the first time, really, in an international conference on the laws of naval warfare. As I said, many of the topics are deferred, and there are clear conflicts that have developed between the Admiralty and the government. The government views peace conferences, as we saw with Salisbury's backdoor proposal to Russia, as a means of addressing financial and budgetary issues. And there's also the conflict that we saw with respect to mercantile interests and the Admiralty, over with the mercantile interests wanting very strict laws of war with regard to shipping so that they can be assured of continuing their commerce during war, and the Admiralty saying, we don't need that, we'll take care of you. Now, I want to skip ahead to this date, 21 October 1904. And even though I'm skipping 5 years, I don't want to suggest that nothing happens of any relevance in that time period. There is a lot that goes on. Britain finds itself in a war in South Africa and experiences a great number of conflicts with neutral nations over the way that they're conducting their blockade and issues involving the immunity of private property at sea. Later on, as you'll see, in the Russo-Japanese War, Britain now experiences being involved sort of in a conflict, but as a neutral. And they're quite aghast when Russia declares food contraband. That goes right to a big problem that Britain has, which is that almost all of their food is shipped in. So there's a lot that goes on there. The United States is trying to impose on the world, to some extent, familiar, their own naval war code. It doesn't fare too well, but there's a lot going on. But we're going to skip ahead to 21 October 1904. Why is this date important? Is it the 99th anniversary of some naval battle, which the commander managed to get himself killed? Is it the date when the Russian fleet showed its gunnery skills against a bunch of fishery boats? Is it the date Jackie Fisher becomes first sea lord? Or is a real significance the fact that that's the date when the United States calls for a second peace conference? Now, while all of these occurred, I think that it needs to be remembered just as much for the fact that it's the date that the U.S. calls for the second peace conference. Because what happens is it's accepted. Britain readily accepts, yeah, we'll go to the second peace conference. And after things sort of start going along, it gets pushed off because of the Russo-Japanese War. And eventually doesn't take place until the summer of 1907. But there is nearly 3 years at which there is planning and preparation for the 1907 peace conference. The Admiralty knows, the Royal Navy knows, that this is going to have a lot of subjects related to us. And now, unlike 1899, when it came upon everyone relatively quickly, in less than a year, we now have a lot of time to think this through and try to plan as to what we're going to do. And that's what they do. I mean, there is 3 years, almost three full years, when in the Admiralty, in the government, there is lots of discussion and planning over what are the positions that the Royal Navy, or in fact Britain, is going to take. There's the Royal Navy and the Admiralty working hard to try to impose their view of what they want the laws of naval warfare to be and what they want the restrictions to be. And it starts almost from the beginning Balfour, who's the Prime Minister, requests a study from the Committee on Imperial Defense with regard to the traditional policy of Britain, which is opposing the immunity of private property at sea. And there is a lot of interest in reversing Britain's traditional policy on the immunity of private property at sea. The Admiralty recognizes that if the traditional policy is reversed, that would benefit the mercantile marine, but they say, as I've said, as long as the fleet has command of the sea, the danger to our commerce will be small, so forget about it. We don't want to do that. Edmund Slade, neat picture, I love his mustache, I don't know if you can see, but it's quite twirled at the end. There's some very interesting descriptions of facial hair in this area. He tells the Assistant Secretary to the Committee of Imperial Defense that having signed the Declaration of Paris, we ought to go the whole hog and basically change our position, except, of course, in the case of blockade. And this, I think, becomes very, this sort of exclusion becomes important as we go along. We also have the Walton Committee is formed in December of 1905 to consider positions to be taken at the conference. Sir George Clark suggests, here's this tension, well, if we can secure a general reduction of naval armaments and check naval competition by changing our traditional opposition to immunity and private property of sea, we should do it. And so here's this tension continuing throughout the era. The government, interestingly, is unable to decide on what position they're going to take on the immunity of private property at sea issue. The mercantile merchant marine interests are putting a lot of pressure on the government to change. They're, you know, making arguments that, look, you know, in this day and age, humanitarian concerns say you should adopt immunity of private property of sea, just like the United States has been advocating since its formation. The government, literally, this topic, immunity of private property of sea, is the last one where the last topic they decide their position on prior to the conference. It is literally only a matter of about 14 days before the conference starts that they finally go back to their traditional position of opposition. And that's what the Walton Committee had decided to recommend. But they have a proviso, even there. After all of this study, it's if you can get a reduction of armaments by trading away the traditional position, we might want to change our view. Now, Fisher is involved in all of these considerations and debates. He's doing it through his letters, which are a joy to read because of his extreme positions. He's doing it by involving Corbett in writing articles. He's even got Mahan helping out because Mahan is a real opponent of the United States position, and Mahan is writing articles that are being published in the British press opposing any change to the opposition to immunity of private property at sea. Now Jackie Fisher is first Sea Lord, and he's not, as he later tried to portray himself after the fact, just aloof from it and says, I don't care. We don't care about the laws of war because we're going to boil prisoners in oil and all that other kind of rhetoric. He tries very hard to get the U.S. Representatives on board with the Admiralty views. He thinks that he's succeeded just before the 1907 conference starts. He says that we've got Choate, the lead U.S. delegate, on board with our position. Turns out he was greatly mistaken. The U.S. pretty much at the 1907 conference turns on Britain and does just about as hard a job as they can, as good a job as they can, to embarrass Britain during the conference. Charles Ottley is the naval delegate who's appointed. Fisher's selection, can't find a picture of him. It'd be great if someone has one. It's interesting because he is described as wearing a pointed beard called a torpedo cut. He consults with Fisher during the conference. Fisher is on holiday in Germany, but in fact he consults with Fisher about issues that come up. He argues for restrictions on the use of mines. He argues for the abolition of the concept of contraband. Now, this is a topic or a point that I'm trying to just work out because the immunity of private property at sea had two exceptions, contraband, and blockade running. If you abolish the concept of contraband, then what are you left with? Blockade running is the way that you can still seize commerce. Britain and the Royal Navy is taking a view of blockade of, you don't need a close blockade. It's sort of, if you're in the, you know, general area of operations. Well, if that's the case, they can seize whoever they want and say, you're running our blockade. You're running our blockade, we're seizing you. I think that the proposal to abolish the definition of contraband was, in effect, sure, we'll throw that to the mercantile interest, but the fact of the matter is, and I'm basing this in part on some documents that I found in the U.S. National Archives, where the U.S. delegation said, wait a minute, if you abolish the definition of contraband, the exception now swallows the rule. Because under Britain's view of what's an enforceable blockade, it's pretty much anywhere. And the Royal Navy is big enough, they're going to say, we declare a blockade, we're going to seize whoever we want. And even if it turns out to be wrong, you know, they're proposing, well, we're going to take it into port and have a prize court that's going to adjudicate this. It's had a sufficient effect. You know, you take the shipping out for a prize court, by the time it's done, not going to get anything. At the 1907 conference, the United States pushes for the immunity of private property at sea. They do it basically to embarrass Britain. Britain tries very hard behind the scenes to say, hang on, don't vote for this, don't bring this up. They push it to a vote. 20-some-odd nations vote in favor of it. Britain, of course, opposes. Britain proposes to abolish contraband, and it fails. In the newspaper that is published about the conference, it's called, and I'm not going to butcher it because my French is non-existent, but it's the British debacle. And one of the reasons why it fails, according to the correspondence, is because of another proposal that the Royal Navy had, which was to allow the sinking of unarmed colliers. That is a pure Fisher proposal. And I say that because at the 1899 conference, there is, you know, non-biased, as near as I can tell, evidence that he actually was proposing that and suggesting it. It's proposed, and it's basically laughed out of the conference. They're like, what, are you crazy? And indeed, one of the leaders of the conference, one of the civilian leaders, writes to Campbell Bannerman and says, unfortunately, this unarmed collier thing, it generally meant that our proposal of abolishing contraband wasn't going to go anywhere because people thought, what are you thinking here? This is just outrageous. Throughout the conference, Britain, and it's mostly because of the positions that the Admiralty wants advocated, becomes viewed as the obstacle to the conference's success. The United States is viewed as cooperating with Germany. And Germany is, you know, just sucking them in. And what you end up with then for the 1907 conference is that the government and Admiralty are in conflict, again over the positions. The government, Admiralty, and mercantile interests are in conflict, primarily over the immunity of private property at sea. The results of the conference are generally viewed unfavorably, although there's a lot of efforts at spin doctoring, at least on the British side. At the end of the day, Britain got basically nothing that they wanted except for the agreement to have a 1909 London conference to talk about this international prize court that they really wanted. Fisher expresses concerns, certainly to Edward VII, that, hey, I'm worried about concerns, whether they're real or not. He's talking about the U.S. and Germany combining against England. And indeed, the 1909 and the 1909 war plans, I have to give a shout-out to my colleague, Dr. Dunley, for finding this, talks about a scenario where the U.S. and Germany are combined against the Royal Navy. Now, what can we then say with regard to this time period that we've looked at? I think that the main takeaway, or the main thing that I'd like to propose here today, is that the 1899 and 1907 peace conferences, and more generally the laws of naval warfare during this time period, deserve a higher standing and a more unified consideration. There is a great debate and great discussion in the pre-First World War Royal Navy historiography going on now. There have been great books by Matthew Seligman, Stephen Cobb, Sean Grimes, even Nicholas Lambert, about this. But no, nobody starts at the 1899 conference, and I don't mean that as a criticism, but they pick up the laws of war to the extent necessary for their arguments, you know, maybe a year or two before the 1907 conference. But I think that the impact and influence of the adaptation of the laws of naval warfare can't be minimized. Clausewitz, in his masterwork on war, dismissed the laws of war as not being relevant to strategic planning within like the first page and a half, and basically says that doesn't matter. I think a more appropriate observation to conclude on was one from Sir Cyprian Bridge in his book, The Art of Naval Warfare, in March of 1907, in which he said that regulations on the conduct of war cannot be ignored in a study of naval warfare, and that the strategy that should guide its operations, the strategist may have to reckon with the international jurist as well as the enemy. And certainly, while nowadays, in modern warfare, that is more clearly the case, in the first decade of the 20th century, I would argue that it is a situation that everyone saw was going to be there and that needed to be studied and should be studied, because it was going to have an impact on the laws of war, especially in naval warfare, in the years to come. Thank you.